don't turn it on yet.
See that they're working correctly. It looks like everything is in order. Let me just begin by saying that this is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry speaking with Professor Othmer in his office at Brooklyn on the 11th of June, 1986. Professor Othmer, the last time we concluded with your work with the group at Cowdersport, Pennsylvania, can you tell me something else about what happened to that plant at Cowdersport?
This plant of the Gray Chemical Company, which we then started in early 1935, as I remember, for making acetic acid from the pyroligneous acid from the wood distillation, was the last word at that time in technology for what was called the wood chemical industry or the wood carbonization industry. In doing so, we took off, of course, the methanol, and that was then refined. During the First World War, this industry had been extremely necessary to the war effort because the acetic acid was converted to calcium acetate by neutralizing with lime and then drying to give dry calcium acetate, which period. This can be pyrolyzed at a relatively low temperature to give acetone and lime. And during the First World War, the acetone was extremely essential and necessary to dissolve cellulose nitrate for use as explosive. At the later time, the calcium acetate was not used for this because acetone came by fermentation in the so-called Weismann process shortly after the First World War, along with butanol. The plant worked successfully. We had some problems, one of which had a very interesting chemical solution. The acetic acid could be made anhydrous, that is above 99.5%, and was shipped as such. However, we were confused and irritated in that the acetic acid, instead of being water white, had a small amount of color in it. And after much work, we discovered this was due to a compound called diacetyl, D-I-A-C-E-T-Y-L. Period. We then found that by the addition of hydrogen peroxide, the diacetyl, one molecule would form two molecules of acetic acid. And our very simple purification process then involved merely the putting of a 2-gallon bottle of concentrated hydrogen peroxide and let it drop drop by drop into the acetic acid as it came from the final purification still. The diacetyl, of course, could not be separated from the acetic acid because it boils too close to it, period. In this way, either in the pipeline going to the final aluminum storage tank or in that tank, the diacetyl well mixed with or the diacetyl in the acetic acid, which was well mixed with the hydrogen peroxide, could react, and by the time the material was shipped, it was water white. Period. 1935, of course, in those years before the Second World War, was the time of the development of the petrochemical industry in this country, and acetic acid had, however, already been made from calcium carbide via acetylene, which, of course, was then reacted to give to give the acetic acid. This had been done in Canada at Shawinigan and also then at Niagara Falls. While these were not petrochemicals, did not come from petroleum, they were still called petrochemicals because later the acetic acid did come directly from the petroleum industry. However, the competition with that from wood distillation and the fact that the charcoal had only a limited market and could not bear the cost of the industry as a whole, it was a dying industry. And of course, only the due to the expansion of industry during the Second World War kept the industry alive until sometime after the war, and by that time the plant itself became non-profitable, was sold, and became ultimately then bankrupt. Because of inflation, however, it was possible to sell the plant for almost what it cost because it was made of such heavy copper, and to sold to another company who used it for its purpose of dehydrating acetic acid.
Do you remember what year it was?
That must have been in the late 40s. Meanwhile, I personally had become so closely associated with the company and my friends there that I built a rather fine home in Cowdersport, which was some 10 miles east of Rowlett and the county seat of Potter County. This was indeed a great source of pleasure to me, and I spent more time designing and building that house than any chemical plant that I had ever worked with. I don't think I'll go into that anymore. Ultimately, the house 300 miles from New York became a snare and a delusion because when I had built it, I thought as a professor I would take 3 months off in the summer and spend it in the lovely country of the Allegheny Plateau and enjoy the friends that I made there. Meanwhile, in 1950, I was married And we did go, but everything had become so busy that we never were able to get up there for longer than one weekend at a time. That was quite impractical because it meant a 600-mile drive, and while the house was as good as I could design and make it with the finest craftsmen from within 150 miles, and a fine architect who came from Rochester, New York, 100 miles north, it was impractical to keep the house. It had 2 miles of electric wire in it, 4 or 5 bedrooms and as many baths, and 2 tons of copper on the roof, with its own water and sewage disposal, and a private bridge over the headwaters of the Allegheny River, which begins just 10 miles east of that bridge. Ultimately, and that was only in 1982, Mrs. Othmer and I gave this rather fine home to the Caldersport Hospital for use as a nurse's home, along with the lake and the 7 acres of beautifully landscaped grounds and gardens which we had put in to beautify the lovely spot. A lovely spring there through 250 gallons of water a minute, cold water, even in the warmest, in the hottest weather, although it a nice place we couldn't use it well enough to justify keeping it. And we've been glad we did give it to the hospital, who use it for a nurse's home in that community which had no facilities for that. And the very fine hospital uses it also as a center for conferences and so forth, for attracting seminars on medical problems. I guess that finishes Caldersport.
Okay. Let's come back to Brooklyn then. The last time we had talked briefly about your position here and how you came to Brooklyn, and the fact that there were just a few people in the chemical engineering department, which had just been split. Chemistry and chemical engineering had been split the year before, as I recall, in 31. What was your first teaching assignment and responsibilities as a new faculty member?
Well, my first teaching assignments, I remember well the first class, which was an evening class. At that time, Polytechnic had a very large undergraduate evening section, a division, as well as the day division, and all graduate courses were taught in the evening. But my first class was a class in fuels and gas and related chemical engineering balances in the evening. I remember walking into the class just on time, and there were some 40 men at 6 o'clock in the evening who looked at me expectantly. I recognized I had to do something, and stepped up and broke out into a loud voice, the start of a lecture, which fortunately I had prepared in advance. I don't know as all of my lectures after that were as well prepared, but at least I did maintain the attention and the definite order in the class. I don't think I was a strict disciplinarian, and I do remember telling that class and other classes that I didn't care whether they came or not. They had paid their fees, which calculated out to be a pretty good amount for each lecture, and if they had something that was worth more than that, they should go. I did appreciate their presence only because in the large classroom, I liked some clothes and bodies to absorb my noise so it didn't echo. By and large, that was also the start of a long and pleasant relationship with many, many students over many, many years. The evening students and the day students all had to do a thesis for both for their undergraduate degrees as well as their graduate degrees. And these were not just mere laboratory assignments. They had to be to come up with a bound a copy of a dissertation at the end of the year, and the inculcation into the young men, and all of the classes in those days were men, of the theory of research, the carrying out of the research, and then the putting that into words and script and finally into a bound volume was quite a task and quite a challenge to get these ideas across, period. I do remember that in one issue of Industrial and Engineering Chemistry, we had five papers, each carrying my name and each carrying the name of someone of my students, and I believe that all five of those were undergraduate theses, which were reported and then published in Industrial and Engineering Chemistry. I mentioned that to indicate that the work that these bachelor's men did was rather worthwhile. Our graduate classes, as I say, were also in the evening, and when it came to theses, for them, these men were mainly employed. Paragraph. I don't know whether I mentioned above, but I'll mention it here and cut if necessary, the fact that during the 30s, the years of the Great Depression, so many men could not go to college that wanted to. Top minds and men of top motivation and ability, they then were able to get jobs. And to pursue the academic work as a graduate students in our evening courses. That was extremely important to them and allowed us to expand our graduate program tremendously. When it came to theses for these men, I always have always told every single candidate for a thesis that I wanted him to work on something that he was interested in because he was going to spend so much time with it. And in this, did I talk about this before?
No.
And in this this case, the men working in individual plants often, of course, were most interested in the work that they were doing. That meant they had to get clearance and in writing from their superior to be able to work on this problem with regard to the making of some chemical in which their company was interested, or some other chemical engineering problem which might be associated with such manufacture. I remember in one case, for example, the company said, no, you can't work with Dr. Othmer because he will then have to become privy to our secrets of manufacture and our production, etc., of this particular chemical, which of course we would like to have studied as to its manufacture. To settle that point, and so that the student could work on a problem of his particular interest, I then signed over my rights in a formal document and as a consultant to that company, for which I acknowledged that I had received, although I never did, $1 a year during the time of this man was working for a doctorate degree. Other paragraph. We usually boasted that Polytechnic was a school of opportunity, and I personally took every opportunity to make whatever adjustments were necessary for students to do their work and to do their thesis under difficulties which pertain to their particular lives. On various occasions, we had students coming from the other side of Philadelphia for our evening classes, coming also even from the other side of New Haven, Connecticut, to our evening classes. And when you consider that these men then, if they stayed in class till 10 o'clock and had 2 or 3 hours of transportation to get home, some very few of them could drive cars to the school, but in any case, it was a very rough schedule for the men involved. And I tried to make it as easy as possible. In several cases or more, we allowed the student to do the thesis research in their company laboratory. And in also in several cases, I remember they doing it when they were no longer taking classes, when they'd finished their class requirements, to do their work at some distance from the Polytechnic, coming in 2 or 3 times during the year only to meet a committee if it was their doctoral committee, or to discuss the matter with me as their advisor. In some cases, they worked with very expensive equipment, pilot plant equipment, and others in companies as far away as Cincinnati, or in one case, even in northern Michigan. And in that particular case, one of my prize students of all time, Dr. Raphael Katzen, he actually had to complete one course in chemical plant design that he had not completed while he was in residence, and I gave that course, and maybe the only course ever given by the Polytechnic by correspondence. He, however, was a very capable, fine student, and has been ever since, and operates 2 or 3 companies under his name in the consulting engineering business now. He was of the class of 1936, which had several other outstanding men, and which I have always felt was the best class of any class in chemical engineering at the Polytechnic. this now we are in 1986, and in the last month, in May, was the 50th anniversary of that class, and some of these outstanding men showed up as heads of their own companies, and very far along in the practice of chemical engineering, a class of which everyone at Poly is proud, and particularly myself.
What companies, were there certain companies that many of these students were working for, or were they quite scattered?
In the 30s, and lesser each decade after that, New York City was the center of three major industries. First, the chemical manufacturing industry. And so many of our major chemical producers had their executive offices, their engineering offices, in many cases their laboratories, either in Manhattan or some of their parts within a few miles, or in the other boroughs of the city of New York. As time went along, the second major industry was the architect engineering industry, with companies like Kellogg, Lummis, Foster Wheeler, and similar companies, all having their offices mainly in downtown New York. At a later time, some of them moved up to the 42nd Street area, and later to the Radio City area. Chemical construction was another one. But these, and the third main industry was the petroleum industry. Exxon, Mobil, and other of the major, Texaco, and so on, were in this field. And of course, between the two was the petrochemical industry, and Union Carbide had always had its offices on 42nd Street in Manhattan. Thus, we had junior engineers, the men with bachelor's degrees that were working in those companies, wanting to carry their engineering and academic work farther, and we offered a very wide range of courses for them here at the Polytechnic. This was implemented by the fact that Borough Hall, Brooklyn, where we are located, was the center of the subway and transportation facilities, and it was either the first, always either the first or the second best location for subway transport of any place in the five boroughs. And as a matter of fact, across from our present building is the transportation building where all of the subways can have access to underground, so they can bring their collection of tokens after midnight at night deep underground and unload them in the transportation building, which is 150 feet away from our 333 J Street. So our graduate work, our evening work, undergraduate, expanded tremendously during the years of the Depression, because while our undergraduate work in the daytime was falling off, people didn't have the money to go to school full-time, we still had this tremendous advantage for our evening work, and including our graduate work. Of course, then came the war, 39 and on, before America got into war. We still were building up a fort in our chemical and engineering industries, so that continued. At the end of the war, the GI Bill of Rights brought a tremendous influx of students, graduate and undergraduate, and as a matter of fact, I had in my first graduate course, which I called Fluid Operations, the largest class ever that I know of, and I think probably ever, in the graduate school at Polytechnic, with some 123 students.